welcome to Monday here on Main Street. We hope you had a wonderful weekend right here in North Dakota. In the second half of today's show, we'll reprise one of our favorite interviews with Dr. Judy Orloff. She writes about empathy and how we should use it in our lives. Plus, we are in the middle of our fall membership drive, and we'll be back in just a moment to ask you to support Prairie Public. But we open today by welcoming Dr. Mark Hegerut. He's the chancellor for the North Dakota University System in front of a conference that's being held at Valley City State University. The conference is Being Human and Working in the Age of AI, and it begins this Thursday, September 26th. Chancellor, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you for having me, Craig. I love your show.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. This is an important conference and a very interesting one. The theme is, of course, being human and working in the age of AI. And this is a new topic. I don't think we would have been having this conversation just 2 or 3 years ago. Can you elaborate on how AI is impacting the human experience, particularly in the workforce?
Well, absolutely. And thanks for taking time with this, because I don't exaggerate when I say this is the biggest thing that's going to happen in the lifetime of people here now and probably being born of the next generation. And I say this from a perspective as a nuclear engineer, former cyber professor, historian of technology professor, that the emergence of artificial intelligence has been predicted for about 150 years. A guy named Samuel Butler first wrote a book called Erewhon. And people should be excited and a little anxious that they're here when it's going to happen. And I can just tell you that the first generations to apply technology will have a huge influence on what comes afterward. What will be its effects? Artificial intelligence is called in some cases a general purpose technology. There's been three in the history since industrialization. One is the engine, steam and gas engine, which absolutely transformed the planet, right? Think of tractors and cars replacing horses.
Sure.
The second was electrification. All right. Think of electrification replacing belt pulleys and augers. And then what we've lived with is information communications technology, which is the laptops, the phones. Well, now scholars are generally saying AI will be of that magnitude. So it's going to cut across all sorts of sectors. It will affect just about all the work we do, unless you are an outward bound person in the Rocky Mountains chopping a piece of wood, you know, with an axe, but just about everybody else is going to have some impact.
If I were to ask you the goal of the conference, what would you tell me the overlying goals are?
The goal is to raise awareness among our university students, the faculty, and the people of North Dakota in general, because I can just tell you they're pouring enormous resources in the corporate world, massive spending, and we believe North Dakotans need to start talking about this, which is why we're honored to partner with the University of Mary, Department of Public Instruction, the Governor's Office, ITD, and then the 11 campus university system to get some great speakers here and get people in the rooms thinking, because we're all going to have to solve this challenge together to make our state more prosperous and allow humans to flourish. It's going to be a generational effort, multi-generational, and everyone, as I say in the Navy background, you know, all hands on deck type of thing.
With a hand in the university's system here in North Dakota, how can you ensure, I guess, that this technology doesn't diminish, shucks, our humanity or our creativity?
Oh, that is a great question. You know, I'm actually co-teaching a course with Dr. Dennis Cooley at NDSU called Artificial Intelligence and Society, the History and Philosophy of the Human and Machine. I like to buy coffee for my students after class, so invited the class to come coffee. And actually, half the class came and got coffee, so I had to spend some money. And one of my bosses, Kurt Viller, state board member, takes great interest in this. He led our AI study group. The state board has a study called Envision 2035. You know, we know you expect us to run, you know, the system day to day and adapt to things, but also there's periodic times where we step back and look out. And so Mr. Viller led the AI study group, and he was there at the class. And you hit a really big question, because ChatGPT can be used to do more work than perhaps maybe freshman, sophomore should have it do, right? Learning the basic, the fundamentals, writing essays, doing math equations. So there is a challenge of not allowing it to diminish human critical thinking, right? Becoming overly dependent. And there's not a clear answer yet on that one. That is an open question, which we'll talk about at the conference too, you know, avoiding negative impacts on student learning. And one of the students shared something shocking with me, a brilliant young man, computer science and ethics double major. I mean, our country will be in good shape when people like him move on up. But he said he stumbled across a study that showed early signs that the IQ of the next gen, Gen Alpha, whatever's coming next, is showing a decline for the first time ever. You know, it's from a very thoughtful student. I haven't found the references myself, but it wouldn't shock me if we're offloading too much of the cognitive work of young people. Now, on the elderly side, and I'm getting up there, I'm less young, I think it'll be tremendous for the continued vitality of people like my father-in-law, who lived to be 92, World War II generation, but he had some cognitive decline. Incredible tool to help him be able to, you know, maintain engagement with this world by having AI-assisted maybe hearing, language, reading. So it's going to be complex, but it's going to be exciting.
I agree with you on the potential for AI to help seniors. It's something our family's thought about in somewhat good detail recently. I mean, I'm getting up there too, and I'm excited how it might be able to help me. But let me ask you this question, and you talked about jobs here in North Dakota. Have you already seen how AI has impacted jobs that are already right here in this state?
Absolutely. Our state is a leading state. People should be proud of your university system in our state. There's an initiative called Grand Farm, of which I was an early supporter years ago. And it's all about artificial intelligence, computation, data, and robotics. And I was at the NDSU alumni dinner last night. I sometimes try to stay over when I'm teaching. They had a vice president, Bobcat. They are now deploying, and I'll try to buy one for my farm, a automated robotic AI-driven mower. So all that tedious work, we've got a big church picnic out at my farm. My wife and I are heading out after work today and start mowing grass and whatnot. So agriculture already, North Dakota's on the map. The governor, Senator Hoeven, Kramer, others behind it. The other thing is Grand Sky up at UND, robotic machines for the air, partnering with the Air Force, which is absolutely an essential national security mission to protect our allies and our country. And then in the oil fields, got a study group with the state board, Kevin Black, who's an oilman himself up in Minot. He was the lead of the study group. We now have in North Dakota, I think it's Hess Corporation, a prototype drill site that is totally automated. They're testing this. I haven't seen it myself, but I ran into to one of the executives saying, yep, we're testing it out. So when it's minus 30, and the humans are getting cold and they can't be on the site, the thing apparently can do, at least in prototype form, but totally automated, artificial intelligence driven, which means the workforce then has to be able to program, monitor. You know, that's a different workforce than just 10 years ago when you had a lot of physical heavy labor, which is still there too. So it's already transforming, not even to mention administrative work, right? ChatGPT, writing outlines of briefings, gathering data through the web instantaneously. You know, academics have to figure that out too, because, you know, copyright and trademark and protecting people's academic work, that's a wide open field. So I could go on, but I know you've got some more.
Sure. You talk about really an AI-enabled workforce, and one of your keynote speakers, and I apologize if I'm butchering the name, but Dr. Aman El-Sheikha. But the question is then, building an AI-enabled workforce, what role do you think the North Dakota University system plays in that? And it's almost, to me, an oxymoron-like question. If we've got artificial intelligence, why do we need the workforce? What's the synergy there, I guess?
Unless we have a breakthrough, what's called artificial general intelligence, okay? And there are theorists who talk about this, that it will be an aid to corporations, government, and the military, okay? As a cybersecurity professor, and you've recently seen this stuff in Israel, which is just shocking with, you know, hijacking phones, and My heart goes out to the Israelis and others to be able to live, you know, in peace. But you're going to need humans in the loop, I think, in a lot of things. Because if AI could be hacked, could be degraded, networks could go down, right? I mean, do you want nobody around? See, right? I mean, you're going to have human backup for things. Maybe they're doing programming, maintenance, but they're there. I think we're going to find in many cases to take control. You know, this goes for medical care, robotic surgeries, you know, so I think it's going to be teaming in many, many cases. Now, in some cases, it may replace, like if you're someone who just manipulates data in the cloud right now, I think you probably want to start diversifying your skill set, right? Because AI in the cloud, data that's already been uploaded, it's going to probably be way ahead of you on that. And they'll need just fewer people checking. But the university system would be crucial to upskilling existing workforce wanting to come back. We're rolling out lots of certificates in all sorts of fields, but then bringing along the new 18-year-olds, right? Then people want to come back. You know, we've got lots of some college, no degree, and then also teaching the teachers. That's one of the biggest challenges, is helping Department of Public Instruction and Ms. Baszler, helping her teachers come up to speed, our teaching schools. That's going to be, I think, one of the big initiatives. And just to let you know, the governor and the legislature have a working group made up of five groups, subgroups, working on AI for the upcoming legislation. And the legislature has a separate subcommittee with Representative Bosch and Senator Davidson studying AI. So there are people studying it. This is a huge event. It's overwhelming in many ways, but the university system will be probably the number one tool for North Dakota to bring this knowledge and skills, working with the business community and government.
I posted this coincidentally about I don't know, 3 weeks ago. It was from an article I read in the New York Times, and it goes along with what we've been talking about. The quote is this, and it's from, I believe, Dr. Thomas Malone from MIT. He said, "We think that computers should be able to replicate humans and replace humans in all ways," Dr. Malone, the MIT professor, said in an article in the New York Times. And so I just posed the question, why are we here? I think it goes along with what you're talking about, this quickly changing, diversifying way that many, many things in many, many fields will be done in our future, in our not too distant future, for sure.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know if he's actually, you know, driven a semi, you know, on an icy road, or I ran nuclear reactors. The Navy's very conservative on nuclear reactors with humans in the loop for obvious reasons, right? And you're just looking at the massive hacking that's gone on, CrowdStrike, Microsoft, airplanes grounded. I really think he's overly ambitious to think a society which is made of humans will turn over to a handful of AI computer programmers, the fate of critical infrastructure, the military, medical care, food production, right? I mean, and that's why we need our state involved. I'd say one of the goals for the conference is North Dakotans need to have a voice. Our state has a long tradition, the progressive era. Look, we're the only state with a state bank, and it's going gangbusters. It's making money. We revealed that you don't have to be a private entity to be a bank, right? Our state was the first one when then Attorney General Heitkamp went to the Supreme Court of the United States arguing that online companies like Amazon should pay sales tax. Eventually, she was proven right when South Dakota went back with Wayfair versus South Dakota and changed the tax structure of the United States coming out of the Dakotas. So we should have a voice, and we need our scholars and our business people and our legislators, you know, bravely engaging this, and don't let this MIT professor make the new world for us. Because if we don't engage, they will remake it for us with values that may not align with Midwestern Dakota values. So
for those who want to Google the article, the headline is "How Self-Driving Cars Get Help from Humans Hundreds of Miles Away." He deals with a world that is after that, where humans don't need to be involved. Just an interesting discussion. All right, back to this conference. Is there still room to register, and where can people learn more?
On the 26th in Valley City. We want to thank Valley City for hosting. We've got this beautiful concert hall convening area, and they should be able to just go online. It's a Dakota Digital Academy. That's what we, by the way, the legislature and the governor helped the state board create a Dakota Digital Academy led by Dr. Todd Pringle, John Deere engineer, to help raise awareness on digital issues, digital skills across the system. So they're actually helping host this conference. So you'd register at www.dda, Dakota Digital Academy, dda.ndus.edu. So that's dda.ndus.edu. More the merrier. It's a big hall.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Mark Hegarat. He is the chancellor for the North Dakota University System in front of the conference Being Human and Working in the Age of AI, which, as he just visited about, begins Thursday, September 26th at Valley City State University. You're going to have a fireside chat with Monsignor James Patrick Shea from the University of Mary. You're going to explore the balance between being human and AI's influence. And can you give us a preview of some of the key points you plan to address?
I've hit on some of them, that this is so big, everybody needs to pay attention, okay? This is not something that maybe, you know, way back in my early days, like, oh, you know, Microsoft has a new Windows technology. Isn't that nice? Oh, well, someone will tell me what to do with that. I think everybody, from those who are young enough to read the news to our seniors, need to study and reflect on what's happening, because there's eventually going to be policy, law, and ethics relating to this. There's going to be laws relating to this. You're going to have legislators and governors taking different positions. So they're going to need the voters to provide informed consent about this. In your companies, companies may rise or fall, much like they did when, think of a transportation company that said, we're sticking with horses instead of that weird contraption that Henry Ford made. They didn't last, right? They didn't last.
Despite sure there were companies that, sure there were companies that said that too, right?
Yeah. And so you think about it, I mean, these general purpose technologies, so we, I'd say this, our great grandparents lived through the emergence of engines and watched our countryside change from horses and mules to tractors and trucks, cars. Our grandparents lived through electrification. Think if our leaders did not fight for electrification back in the 1930s, what our state would look like, right? They didn't just wait for somebody from New York to come help them. They're like, we've got to do this. And we built these wonderful co-ops across our state that brought lights to our homes. My father was born outside Mandan in 1936 with kerosene lamps and his grandmother as a midwife. Electrification changed their lives a few years later, right? And then you and I might be old enough. I think we're both 39, right? That, you know, when we first got a desktop computer, it kind of sat there for a long time, right? And then I remember I plugged in a 1992 Zenith laptop with an internet port at 2400 baud. It changed our world, right? Well, it's happening again. So that's going to be the main message. But the other thing I'd say is to lower the blood pressure. And I want to thank my state board that I've adopted as chancellor a strategy in my job. And it's actually just going to be published on Tuesday in Johns Hopkins University Press about how to survive the age of AI in university systems. And it's a strategy of resilience. I think it applies to all of us. And that is day to day, reliably do what you're doing right now. Just get up, put your shoes on, go to work, be there. Second, be alert when you have to adapt. Think of COVID. You have to adapt. We had to change some practices, go online. But then you have to be alert for transformability when things profoundly change. And some people say, well, continuous adaptation is fine. But, you know, continuous adaptation of the candle did not lead to the electric light bulb, right? I mean, my grandparents on the farm realized as much as we trim the wick and get new kerosene, we've got to buy in shares into the co-op in Morton County to get that electricity, right? And it transformed their life. So that's the approach I'm going to take. Raise awareness. We all need to be engaged. Our state and our region has a unique voice, I think. But then also in your day-to-day, don't be too anxious on any one day, but be alert to it and work on those three levels of reliability, adaptability, and periodic transformability.
Chancellor, before we let you go, I want to go way back to, the comments you made about the very bright student who you had coffee with. Mm-hmm. What about AI and ethics? And how is the North Dakota university system today, incorporating ethical considerations into AI relative to education and development of the university system?
Well, great question. And the state board studied that as well. I want to thank Dr. Lucian Stone, Dr. Wells and Dickinson, and Dr. Dennis Cooley. They worked with Ms. Dini Dabai and Dr. Van Horn of Mayville to lead a group called Values. It was a study group that we don't want to be just machine minders, wrench turners. We want to have robust values inculcated in North Dakota students. That's, like I say, we have a public trust of money. We have a sacred trust of our children. And so values in the age of AI are going to be challenged, okay? Already, they're inventing companions that might follow someone through life, be a tutor, okay? Bronkman said this, you know, the co-founder of OpenAI is from North Dakota, and he said, you may have a tutor companion for life. What are the values and norms programmed into this tutor?
That is scary, scary, scary thought to me. By the way, it truly is, right? I mean, yeah. Who is adapting the roadmap for that AI bot in that example?
That's why for our state, we have to be sure, I believe, that with all of our energy here, AI is going to actually, our economy is going to boom with data centers. If we have the right profit sharing and taxation, we will become the home of probably massive data centers given our weather and our energy. But we have got to be sure we have access to large language models for North Dakota that is answerable to our legislature, answerable to our people, and it will be a boon for business. Start a business in North Dakota and you come with access to large language models of NVIDIA chips. I think it could bring business here, but we've got to negotiate very carefully with these big companies because the first indications in my conversations and some of my presence is they're hesitant to do that. They want us to come and buy the service from them. Well, let's think differently. Just like we built our own stage net, our own co-ops, our own mill, our state bank, North Dakota might have a third way to do this. And I think that'll be the big question for our legislature and the new governor.
A lot of discussion about AI is coming our way. You can be a part of it at a conference, Being Human and Working in the Age of AI. It begins Thursday, September 26th at Valley City State University. You can still register by going to dda.ndus.edu. And it's been our pleasure to have Dr. Mark Hegarat. He's the Chancellor for the North Dakota University System as our guest today. Chancellor, I am guessing this is not the last time we're going to have a conversation about AI.
Well, let's have some more and drop by our class sometime. These are brilliant kids. The future's in good hands with young people like that. And I apologize to them here. They're not kids. They're 18, 19, and 20. But compared to me, I wish I was their age.
I don't disagree with you at all there, and I'll take you up on that. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Hegarat. Dr. Orloff, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Your book is The Genius of Empathy, and as we discussed briefly off mic, it's a wonderful topic to consider in this world of bullying and all the noise we hear about the pressures of mental health and social media, etc. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about the book, but please tell me, what was the genesis of this book for you?
The genesis of this book was that I believe that empathy is the force that can help heal our families, our communities, and the world. I feel that it is that powerful and an important skill to learn, especially for children and parents and then young adults and in every situation. And so for that reason, I wanted to devote a book entirely on empathy to give people skills to be able to find empathy in even difficult situations.
Define for me, what is empathy?
Empathy is the ability to see something from another person's point of view without necessarily judging it, and to just be able to observe how they're seeing it and then establish your goal. What do I want to do with this person? Do I want to get through to this person? And then establish how to do that by wanting to know their point of view. You might not agree with their point of view. And that's a point I stress in the book, is that we have to get used to finding empathy for people we disagree with. That's a very important aspect of it.
You mentioned a single word as we had our introduction, and that word was learn. You talk about it throughout the book, that you're not born with empathy, or you may be perhaps, but you can really learn how to be empathetic.
Yes. I mean, that's the premise of the book, is that we all can learn if we want to. If we want to have better relationships with our spouse, with our children, with teachers, with, everyone in your life, empathy can help you do that. And empathy is about caring what other people think and where they're coming from. It's just really important. As people, I'm a psychiatrist and I've worked with patients for, 20 years. And what they all want is to be seen, to be heard, and to become valued. That's the basic desire of all people, no matter who they are on the outside. And so it's important in your communication, one of the first skills in learning how to express empathy is letting somebody know that you heard them. You might not agree with them, but you can say, I heard you. I'm going to give it some thought. And thank you. You don't have to agree with them, but then that's the alternative for getting into an argument or getting bitter or blaming or shaming or pointing the finger at somebody.
Like sending an email to someone and then getting a reply that said, I heard your point of view, but I disagree with it, rather than not getting any response from your email at all.
Yes. Oh, the no response creates a lot of anger and resentment in people. So you want to be very careful not to do that, because then somebody feels like they're not heard at all, and that makes them irate.
You discuss the importance of self-empathy in your book. Explain that to me and how that differs from self-compassion and why it's crucial for personal healing.
Yes, I have a whole chapter in the book on self-empathy. It's about how to have empathy with yourself rather than putting yourself down and having those negative voices in your mind go round and round in a way that is destructive. So it's about saying, if you had a hard day, to say, you know, you did the best you could. It was an impossible situation and you got through it. Bravo. You know, this is the way one talks to oneself when they're empathetic. Now, we can't do everything perfectly all the time, but what we can do is show empathy for ourselves. And everybody goes through so much. I know that. And sometimes you can't tell what people are going through because they put on a pretty good front. But I'm, from my perspective as a psychiatrist, I know everybody has their own struggles. And so that's important to realize. It's a form of empathy, and it's how you treat yourself in an ongoing way. And it's a way to shut down the negative voices in your mind that can be so self-destructive. And, you know, my feeling is that we could make progress by just beating ourselves up a little bit less each day, because I know people are hard on themselves. And so a little bit of progress each day is a form of self-empathy.
Dr. Orloff, you write about that empathy is not just about being nice. Can you please tell me more about that?
Oh, yes. It's not just about being nice. It's about being discerning. It's about being able to assess how to approach people and how to get along with them and how to have better relationships. It's not about being nice or phony or being a people pleaser. Now, a lot of highly empathic people are people pleasers, and it's something they need to work with. And I have many tools in the book on how to, you know, not be a people pleaser, but be more true to yourself. People pleasing is a form of codependency. So that's a little bit different. And so you need to be kind to yourself and listen to yourself as a very important vote in everything you do. A misconception that a lot of people have about empathy is that you're weak, or that you bend to pressure, or that you can't stand up for yourself, or you just will absorb all the pain of the world into your own body, and you'll have to, you know, bear the brunt of compassion fatigue. That is not true if you have the tools that I'm sharing in the book in terms of setting clear boundaries with people. Now, somebody can ask you to do something and you know you can't do it, but the way you respond from an empathic point of view is to say, you know, I hear how important that is to you, but unfortunately, I just don't have the time to get involved right now, but I wish you the best of luck. And so that's setting what I call a positive boundary. It's not a wishy-washy boundary. It's not a mean boundary. It's a positive boundary, and it's not just being sugary sweet or nice. It has nothing to do with that. Although, if you're empathic, you will be perceived as nice.
You write about different empathy styles. That was interesting and educational for me. I believe my notes have cognitive, emotional, intuitive, and spiritual.
Right, and it's important that we could identify what style our loved ones are, our friends or coworkers, perhaps if we don't get along with them and we want to get along with them. So cognitive empathy is being able to feel empathy with your mind. You can say, I'm so sorry you went through that, and express, you know, a really beautiful expression of empathy, but you don't really feel it. You're not a feeling person. You're more a cerebral person, which is okay. You know, it's fine. I feel, you know, the more empathy we have on any level is good. And then the second kind is emotional empathy. And this is where many caring people feel what you're going through with their hearts. And they tend to become emotional sponges and take on the suffering or the problems of other people. And that needs to be shifted. And I have a big section in The Genius of Empathy on how to be with people and not take on their emotions. That's one of the skills. And then another kind of empathy is intuitive empathy, where you just naturally get intuitive flashes about people. You get gut feelings that are empathic. You get images, you get aha feelings, you get hunches. And so that's the way your empathy operates in a default setting. And then the final type of empathy is spiritual empathy. And I'm sure you've met, you know, these kinds of people who just see the best in everybody. They see, you know, what is the potential in this person. And they see things from a spiritual and very loving, accepting point of view. The problem is that sometimes they don't see the whole person. They only see the best in them. And human beings have a very fierce, dark side, you know, and everybody knows that. So it's important to be able to recognize, you know, what is this person's obstacle? What is this person's dark side, and how do I want to handle it? So there are positives and negatives with each type of empathy.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Judith Orloff. Her book is The Genius of Empathy. She is a board-certified psychiatrist, intuitive healer, and New York Times best-selling author for her work on empathy, emotional healing, and the intersection of traditional medicine and spirituality. She's a member of the UCLA psychiatric clinical staff. Dr. Orloff, you write a section in your book on how empathetic people can deal with bullies. I think it's one of the most important parts of your book. What should we take away from that?
Oh, it's so critical. You know, I just had, you know, my partner's grandson come visit us, and he is experiencing so much bullying in school. He's 8 years old, and you know, it's a real problem, and it really hurts the kids, and it hurts adults who are bullied. But what you want to do if you're in a bullying situation is, number one, identify the bully and listen if it's a child or listen if it's an adult, and to get some help with that. Because what happens with children is they sometimes lash out at a bully, and then the child who is defending themselves get blamed for the problem. It gets kicked out of school or something like that. So you need to have an adult in the school system or in the resource system at work to come in and evaluate the situation, because many companies have zero tolerance for bullying, and many schools do. And so you want to get the help of somebody, you know, who can come in. You don't want to do it yourself. It doesn't usually turn out that well. And so you incorporate the help of, you know, the resource section of wherever you are, and you get some help in dealing with it. And you deal with the bully, the one who is bullying, and you deal with the victim, because it's very, very painful to be bullied. And so the one who is being bullied, you know, needs to have that empathic help. And you're not alone. And we're going to come in and solve the situation.
And I should stress that I think perhaps this is intuitive, but this is not just about youth who are being bullied. Many of us, for example, in work environments that are highly competitive, we're pushed around. We're bullied every now and then.
Oh, yeah, it's true. If it's every now and then, it's one thing. If it's every day, it's another thing. Because chronic bullying can have negative effects on your mental health and your physical health. It's a horrible way to live. No, luckily I've had, you know, small incidences of bullying, so at least I could get a sense of it. And you just have to have a big no to it. You know, there's no leeway there. But with children especially, because they need help. But in the workplace, if there's bullying going on, or if somebody's shaming you or blaming you, something like that, if you're in the book, I have different kinds of coworkers who might be difficult to deal with, and how empathy can help you establish a better relationship with them.
Dr. Judith Orloff is a board-certified psychiatrist, intuitive healer, and New York Times best-selling author. She's written her latest book, The Genius of Empathy. Dr. Orloff, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed being on your show.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding number 1 is about sacred relatives. It states, Native people practice a deep interconnectedness with the land, the resources, the water, all living things, and all human beings. Land stewardship, respect for all two-legged, four-legged, winged, crawlers, and swimmers and a strong belief in the sacredness of all human beings are key elements for our spirituality.
In this episode of Dakota Dade Book, we'll hear from Kevin Locke, enrolled member of the Standing Rock Nation, in part three of Hihankaga and the Milky Way.
And so they asked that name because he asked that name because when they give that name out, then whoever gives that name, they'll in their prayer, they'll announce out to all the directions, all of creation, so that they can receive that person, that name, with that name. And then throughout your life, all of creation observes you. All of creation sees you. Everything is witness to your life, you see. So then when Hihankaka asks your name, then instantly Hihankaka knows who you are. And then so that you can't stop. Because there's no stillness. Everything's in motion. And so, but Hihankaka has the option of standing in place, in which case you have to go on that road that trails out to nothing, right? Or Hihankaka can step to the side and you can go on straight on that journey through eternity, see? But see, none of us knows our fate. None of us knows that. So that's why, the Lakota people would have the custom, they would maybe take a lock of hair from a departed loved one, and somebody would keep that. And then the family will devote maybe 1, 2, 3, or 4 years to performing self-abnegating, altruistic deeds in the name of that departed loved one. Mm. Because the belief is that our ties are so close that we have the opportunity here to do these things to help our loved one in their name continue on, see? So, things like that. But I'm just, your question was about our natural environment. But you see, you can't do that in Manhattan. You see, grandson? No, I guess you can't see that.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Dade Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
As we wrap things up today on Main Street, we want to thank you so much for supporting us. It's deeply appreciated. You still have time to pledge your support to Prairie Public this hour by hopping on our website at prairiepublic.org or by calling us at 800-359-4145. We will be so thankful if you become a pledging member right now. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll learn about anticipatory trauma reaction. How does this type of trauma differ from trauma experience after an actual event? Dr. Gregory Jantz, one of our country's leading experts on this type of trauma, will be our guest. Remember, we hope you pledge your support right now in support of Main Street.